Name, rank, and serial. RA14885531. That's it, sir. And the rest of you just give your finger up. That's what it was. And it's the same thing instituted into my culture, except my grandfather's grandfather's grandfather forgot to tell his children's children's children what the reasons were. So what happens in this 20th century is that I wind up, what was that thing? Is that a letter come proclaim something, mystery of faith? We don't know why we believe in something, but we believe in it. So here was almost the same idea. Something was instituted into it, brainwashed in it, but we forgot to tell the reasons why. But there is, the Indian trying to survive in Florida, or wherever they come from, if they went to the first non-Indian, looked very friendly, and started telling them all about himself, what kind of animals he eats, what type of fish he likes, and this particular part of the country, there's guava trees, and that's what they really love to eat. So this white boy or somebody more goes, man, hey, boy, they like to eat this guava tree, and they all congregate this time of the year when these guavas are ripe. So common sense tells the army guy, that's the best time to go capture them. And believe me, it had happened. We've had non-Indian people who an Indian girl married, shacked up, or whatever it is back in those days, they must eat in that marriage or something. Stayed with the Indian just so long to do one purpose, and it was to be a trader. He learned and he studied them. And then one day, he gave the key word, when to capture these people. Years ago, we used to go hunting. I think all mankind, one time or another, did this. When you read about the King of England and Robin Hood and all these little things, you always heard about hunting parties. They go out to hunt for days and days, and they dried up the meat and brought it back. Indians did the same thing. I think every organization of mankind does that. And the reason why they hunt, you have to eat. So this person figured out when these people go out to hunt and about how long they went out to hunt. And then once he figured this out, what he did is when this hunting party went out to go hunt, he went and told the military, and a lot of our women used to be captured. The last ones that was captured around Fort Myers, Naples area. The Indian women love to tell that story how this friend of theirs told them that they are going to go meet somebody, and they're going to come to visit them. And it was the military troops that was coming down. But he didn't tell them that part, so the Indian women just thought they had a lot of visitors coming. So they all put on their capes. I guess they didn't have no lipstick or anything back then, but they did spruce up a little bit. Sure enough, the military surrounded them, and almost instantly captured them, made them walk all the way to Fort Myers, loaded them up on boats, and off they went to Oklahoma on a nice journey. And so these type of things took place. So the reason why we don't tell stories to somebody else anymore is because of that reason. So today I still feel a little guilty, but my reasons are different now. I don't want to tell you everything, because if I told you everything, then I wouldn't be important to you. You got to keep a little trick back. But anyway, the main reason, truthfully though, the main reason if I don't tell you anything is because I just don't know everything. I'm just sharing with you what I know in a very, very small portion of our Seminole country. Indians live during the pursuit. They wind up down in Fort Lauderdale area. It was known as Fort Lauderdale. Yes, it was Fort Lauderdale. In the mango country. Every place where you see where Indians that went far south, somewhere they were in an unreachable type location where there was mangoes along the ocean. Somewhere down in the Chicolotu area, again in the mango country. The others stayed around in like Indian River area, and those were what you call the Creek Indians. Today there's actually two tribes, not Seminole and Miccosukee, but Miccosukee and Muscogee. The Muscogee people is just as different in their language and their customs as Americans and Russia. I haven't even, if I say vodka, is that Russian? That's the only word I know, I think. But the cultures are so different. But the only reason why they are together today is because of the common bond of warfare and trying to escape from it. Muskogee Indians are northern type country, but they also, the older generation spoke many languages. But in recent times, they can speak Muskogee and this other language called Hichidi, or the language of the Miccosukee. Then the other ones even spoke Spanish and English. I'm just barely getting along in English and in my own language. So the word Seminole, later on, I guess back in the 1700s, 1800s, when Andrew Jackson went down here, maybe somebody a little before him, started capturing a lot of these black slaves that was in this somewhere around this particular country here. And they started this term Cimarrone, but picked up pretty good in Indian language, and I guess Mongolian, but we don't have an R sound in a lot of language. This R sound is replaced with an L sound. So the word Cimarrones, the L came in from, replaced the R, it came out Cimarrone. And I guess they took our mispronunciation of the Spanish word Cimarrones, and we said Cimanole, and then it became documented in American history as Seminoles. And they left us alone after the Civil War, and the war did not erupt all the time from what I understand, because a lot of non-Indians that came from Georgia either running away from the Civil War themselves or just maybe new territory came down in here, and they survived together. Occasionally, somebody from another country come down to instigate something, and we would wind up killing them, or a barroom fight or something, and then a war would erupt. But then the history only tells, since the historians or the military side, they only tell their version as the way they want their history to be remembered. What they say about history is a bunch of bullshit piled together and compromised on, or a bunch of lies put together, I think is what history is. And sometimes I believe that in modern day of it. So when I hear somebody tell me, oh, I know your history real good, I think, my goodness, go ahead and tell me. I want to hear your lie. But each person, each one of you, are going to write some history down. It's going to be different from this one, this one, this one. So it just depends on who was lucky enough to write the history. But I really appreciate those folks doing that, so I, at least I can pick up some keyword and puzzle the rest of it out to figure out what was going on at that time. That's what is beautiful about history. So in 1900, some of the things that we are told in our country is never to buy and own land. That was not an order of the country from what I found out from the Franciscan document. What took place is that since the Spanish or the French or the British, whoever they were, trying to conquer these Indians, and they were the subject of being pushed, they were just given this problem of, we do not want these people to ever own any land. If they do, they might get enough money and buy the land back or something. But in today's system, you get the feeling that it is the law of the land and God said so. Because in our day, my grandfather said, you never buy land because the land belongs to everybody and God didn't mean it to be merchandise. But to me, in modern day, I think that's a bunch of crap. If I was a military pursuing these people, I would have said the same thing so I know where they are, that they never gain and never get up and start dictating the other one. So that's what that was. But today you would think that this is the way it was said. So we cannot own any land. My grandfather used to go out there and kill a bunch of egrets for the French one time. My goodness, 10 cents a plume. You know what 10 cents was back in the 1800s? Quite a bit of money. I hear stories about my grandpa coming down in a canoe and Joel Franks and Jeanette's grandfather. I think we got the same grandfather, isn't it? Okay, we're in different lands. My father was a rural guy or something, my grandpa. They say he would go into town with a whole bunch of egret feathers, come back with piles of money, pushing that canoe out of the swamp, or into the swamp. Since he had a lot of money, I often wondered, common sense would have told him to go buy some land. My goodness, 10 cents a plume. And the land was being almost given away at 25 cents an acre. My goodness, he could almost own whole Florida with it. It didn't go that way. And it was because of that that they did not want the Indians. They made us where we were not citizens. We didn't have any rights. And if you're not a citizen and you don't have any rights, you don't own any land. But you can purchase what the people have. So that's instituted, and today we still have that problem. A lot of our old timers that's holding the medicine bundle still adheres to this. One time, back in 1949, 1950, we went through a land claim settlement that the United States government said, it's been 150 years now since we took your land or something like this, but we are going to open our doors up, open our arms up, so you can sue us for what you think you took from us. So some lawyers got together. I wouldn't have the slightest idea what they were talking about myself during that time. But they said, you can sue us for how much land we took from you because you never signed a peace treaty. So they came out with some crazy price, and the land marking where they thought the Creeks and the Seminoles or Muscogees and Miccosukees wrong, and they were, and they used that word wrong, maybe we did, but it went all the way up to Georgia, Missouri, Tennessee, Arkansas, Ohio area, wasn't it? Well, almost up into Canada. And so whatever acres it was, it come out to about $16 million. So that land was awarded to the Florida. And later on, the Oklahoma is the one that was taken to, Indians that were taken to Oklahoma joined suit. So we have to split the money of the $16 million. And back then, I think it was 700 and some odd, about 700 people in 1912. And they had a number of about 2,000, wasn't it? 2,000 in Oklahoma. So what the United States government is telling us now, this money that setting an escrow for is collecting interest, is to split it for capital payment. So we said, no, we want half of the money. Or we want all of the money. They go, why? Because although you picked them up and took some of these people up to Oklahoma, a lot of the Indians, even though they might have been betrayed, accepted their bribe or their payment and went on the trail. The ones that were not put on the boats to go up there in a hostile situation, that were put in a hostile situation, were forced march to go up there. Today, start thinking about this forced march seems like it'd be painful situation, but you got to remember that was back then, and the only transportation I think they would have known is walking, right? Must not have been to do that, except it was just a long journey. So today, with this land, the monies that we have is sitting in escrow. It has reached over in excess of $40 million. And we have not settled it because the holder of our medicine bundles and our teachings tells us, with that one thought, do not accept money for the land that was purchased or what they're paying for. You're not supposed to sell the land. But the problem we're having is that the settlement was already settled. It is just sitting in the bank. So it's ours already. But in a modern, all the way to this day, the reason why I don't touch it is because it's collecting interest and I know it's going to be there. Okay? And you know what money does? It can make a powerful son of a gun out of you, or it can make a beggar out of you. So the best thing to do is leave it in. I've never had so much money in my pocket at one time and I'm not doing anything. And if they don't know too much about it, just leave it there while they're still confused about it. So for once in my life, I'm using the confusion to my advantage as a leader. I'm not Oliver North now. I don't know what else I can tell you, bringing you up to that time. There used to be an old saying, does any of them get money for living on a reservation? Yeah, they sure did. Back in the 1800s, they put a piece of land out here, up at Port Charlotte, went all the way across to about old Lake Wells, went straight down about the middle of Okeechobee Lake, all the way down to the tip of Cape Sabalon area. They called it the Macombs Reservation. What?
Treaty Reservation.
Treaty Reservation. They said, all Indians in the state of Florida to go down to this reservation, we will pay you to live on that reservation. And that's several million, 5 million acres, I think it is. I think it's that number. It's quite a large area. And the military did pay them. That was in 1858, 45, or something like that, something in that stretch. Yes, they did get paid to stay on that reservation. But somewhere the Civil War broke out. They forgot about it, and they put a 25-mile buffer zone on it, the DMZ of Florida, where no Caucasian get on that, no Indian go beyond the other. But somehow they violated that, and today, today, we don't own that no more. We don't even know what happened to that claim. But I still look at the chart and see where that property was. I don't go pouting over it that I've lost it. You got to remember, I'm in today's man. But there is a very small group of people, about 200 Indians, who do not belong to the Seminole Tribe of Florida as an organization recognized by the government, or Miccosukee Tribe of Florida, an organization recognized by the government. There is a group that is still an aboriginal individual, the person still possesses this aboriginal individual rights of that land. They do not have an organizational chart to say we will attack the government as an organization. They are not looked upon that way. But they do have the privilege under Indian health care, getting away from that payment of the land item. Does an Indian get paid to live on a reservation? Let me back up just a little bit. That time, they did get paid. Today, no, they don't. But the United States did go through a transition period that someone said that since more non-Indians are dominating, they found out how many Indians were in Florida. Since they were pushed down to less than 200, and there's, I don't know how many military were then, there were more than them. Best thing to do is just leave them alone. Civil War broke out, and it finally ended. Everybody was kind of hospitable at that particular point, feeling kind of good that they didn't die. And they started leaving these indigenous people alone, and became a novelty. Started becoming part of the tourist industry. Oh, let's go down to Miami and look at some Indians. So some tourists attracted minded people, started developing little zoos, and in that zoo, there were some Indians living there. I was born in one. It's a pansy farm out there. I find I look like Mason. I still swing from trees pretty good, too. But anyway, I was born in a chimpanzee farm, a tourist attraction. That's where we made our money. Today, guess what I do, and it's the bottom of my heart. I'm an alligator wrestler, and I develop tours, villages. Still enjoy the heck out of ripping the tours off. I'm born in it, why not, you know? And but we haven't made a difference. But personally, I have gained quite a bit of income from doing that. And I love it. So back then, what seemed like a humble surrounding has been my fortune in one particular sense as an individual. Other people are humble there. So the United States now saying that we need to educate these Indians and give them all kind of benefits. And Seminole other tribes in the United States became organized somehow and had reservations. We didn't receive our first reservation until 1922 in the Hollywood Indian Reservation, I believe. And it was about 1,000 acres. Today it's only about 500 acres. Then in 1934, they purchased some more land in Big Cypress Indian Reservation, which is about 46,000 acres. And then we purchased some land above the Okeechobee Lake, right on the shorelines, between Fish Eating Creek, Harney Pond Canal, and Kissimmee River, about 34,000 acres. And Indians were reluctant to go live on the reservation, but little by little, they moved on. Someone had the foresight to see that they didn't have this privilege of going anywhere they want anymore. They saw their lands being consumed by realty people, land developers. So today we live on the reservations. So on the reservation, they gave us some things. It was called, we will give you Indian Health Service. That's to give you some medication. They did not say they were going to give us facelifts, taking the fat off your gut, giving you real, they will take care of a certain amount of your dental problems, glasses, but we call it a band-aid job. If you want something greater than the band-aid job, go work and do it. I mean, how much more can you do something? But some Indians think that the United States is supposed to give them a total handout, and we do have that problem, where they think, I am not going to go off the reservation and find myself a job because the government is going to sponsor me on something anyway. That's a bunch of bull. We have Indians who are in poverty, not because of, they just don't know how to take advantage. You've got tons of them in your country. That's why you have a welfare program. And or somebody just does not want to do anything to advance. They just want to leech off. Either they're all lazy. We have that too. We have an educational program, and anybody in the government does put a certain amount of monies to it. But recently, we started making a little influx of money, so we put a lot more money into our education program than the government does. My goodness, there's a whole aura of things, and I'll let Joel talk about the different programs that we have in a few minutes. But with these type of things, our reservations are recognized as districts in Florida. The United States has one big boundary line, and you notice that somehow the reason why the United States is so powerful is because no one has a claim to it. If they do, they sure bounce them around a little bit. So they even made it even more confusing. Instead of calling the United States, now they went into individual states known as states. That gets more confusing. They take the states and cut them down into counties. Even crazier, you get down to districts, then regions first. Regions to districts, down to communities and little metropolitan areas. Each one of them has a little government. We are known as a district in Florida. And in the state, under the government's eyes, we are known as District 13, 14, something. And we get a certain amount of windfall profits that comes to us. We use that for whatever we're going to do. Since we are in the state of Florida, although Seminole Indians of Florida, Seminole Tribe of Florida is a nation, a sovereign nation, but we do not have the war powers. Main reason why? If I could do a lot of damage with 2,200 Indians, give me the right uranium and maybe some explosive, maybe that could be something. But we are known as not as an independent nation like the United States, Russia, or any of these other countries. We are a dependent nation within a nation. Why? Because we are in the United States, in the country, in the state of Florida, in the boundaries of Florida. So we are dependent on that mother sovereign nation known as the United States and Florida. So going down just a little bit more, why did Seminole Indians go in the bingo? Somebody wrote me a constitutional chart saying that I can do anything I want as a nation under the confinements of the United States, and what state of Florida tells me, or what it does, I can also do it under the right. And that right says that anything that the state does, which is regulatory, civil regulatory, I can do. Which simply means that state of Florida, if you don't know nothing about your government, you've got a bunch of people out there that is voted and stuck up there, and they're supposed to make some decisions for you, how you yin-yang your life around. And believe me, they do that. And they vote. So if they had decided that a bingo gaming was going to be allowed in the state of Florida, could be any organization, and it's non-profit, whatever. But my law said that anything that the state allows to be played, I can change the rules the way I want it as a sovereign nation and play it the way I want to because the state allows it. But if the state doesn't allow it, like cockfights, pig fights, pit bull fights, there's no rules about it and it's against the law, that is criminal and prohibitory, not civil and regulatory. It's just a little loophole that took place that we saw and went at it. And I guess you have to learn how to read and write first, so we all went to school and did a little bit of that. The reason why we went under heavy attack was that if I was the King Kong of Florida, and I was the guy that owned the horse track, and I was the guy that owned the dog track and the high life, and I fought so hard to put this in place with somebody's money, somebody died for it, somebody got their nose bent over, maybe their head knocked off a couple of times for it, and money's pushed over to your capital to raise that hand to say allow it. And then some guy like me come in there and said, yeah, I'm going to put up a dog track right on the Indian reservation. Boy, these guys who own it will say, hey, you hadn't paid your price. That's the exact words that I've heard. All you're doing is just leeching off. But bingo, nobody said a damn thing. Matter of fact, the Archbishop of the Catholic Church gave us a blessing. And the reason why we are in bingo today is because no particular group control bingo in Florida, because they never dreamed that a bunch of Indians out here was going to work some things out. So we did get past that point. So we are known in the state of Florida now as the guys who play big time bingo. And thank goodness for that little loophole, because we do make some monies off of it. But before the history of bingo, there were cigarettes. Florida did something very benevolent that the Indians almost screwed up themselves. I couldn't believe it, like a little kid, you know, candy, you know. Set it in front of them and say, one candy a day now. You think that kid's going to do it? No, take as much as he can, and cheek be all puckered out of it. We did the same thing with cigarettes. Somewhere, someplace, somebody's greediness, somebody's selfishness, somebody, something, took place where they convinced the state of Florida to allow the Indians to sell one precious commodity that makes a lot of money for the state of Florida, called cigarettes. And the taxes on it is very heavy. So they went and convinced the state politicians to allow the Indians to sell these cartons of cigarettes or cigarettes and sell it lesser and keep the taxes that they generate on it. Holy mackerel, I couldn't believe it. They were making $6 million, $8 million off of it. But was it going to the Indians? No. Somebody was pocketing and having a good time. It's just a conniving way that happens in the United States and in the state of Florida and amongst ourselves. And guess who the culprit was? The Indians themselves. So we go through that. It's a good old boy back home. So we finally straightened that out, and to the point, so when I came in 1979, instead of bootlegging cigarettes in, I told the state of Florida that he allowed me to sell some more cigarettes and utilize the monies for my governmental purposes. And you'd give me the blessing again, I would like to try it. So we did, since I'm in politics there. I'm in politics among my own people. I'm voted in every 4 years. And I'm playing with another political group of people who are voted in every 2 years or every 4 years or every 6 years, one way or the other. So I have to play around on both sides. And so I convinced them that I'm going to fight the screw down in Florida, I mean, down in Indian country. And some of the things was, make sure that no one underage buys it. Make sure it's only 3 cartons. And I forget, I think those are the main. Oh, and the other one is we buy from state licensed tobacco wholesaler. And that all documents will be kept by the wholesaler because he was given an Indian stamp. So if you buy a cigarette off of us or a carton, you'll see underneath it, it says Indian. That is our stamp saying where it came from. Why do they do that? So they can know and regulate what type of monies is being generated down there. It was very fair. I mean, the simplest thing on earth is to stick your head out the window and sell a carton of cigarettes to this person and get the money and come to the government and we sell off. So if somebody, if an Indian person ever comes to me and says, Florida has done a GE plan for me, he's crazy. It has been given so much darn opportunities, except the Indians themselves, it's like a big hog pen, they kind of kick each other on. We have our fight just like the state of Florida does itself. 1957, we became organized the Seminole Tribe of Florida. Forgot exactly what date. That was the day that we started receiving all these Indian health programs, certain type of government programs that goes to a county or a state. We started receiving those same type of benefits. You go to there must be some sort of state-run or county-run clinic here in this county somewhere. I guarantee there is something of that nature here. We have that same setup on our reservation, except it is specifically channeled through Washington and down to us. It doesn't come from the state. There are certain some type of programs that is channeled from the state to us. But I have to be careful how much money I get from the state because they have allowed me to sell cigarettes, and it's way in excess of what they give me. They only give me $20,000 for scholarship funds. Hell, I'm making $6 million over here. But I'll still accept what they give me because they think they're doing something. Yet they're giving me $6 million over here. I often felt kind of guilty holding this $20,000, but it's nice to go ahead and take it. And so you look at that and watch this money. You'll spend this. I'm starting to lose track here. So 1957, we became organized. And what my grandfather, what my uncle now, is my grandfather's son, my great-grandfather's son now, his name is Frank Billy, he organized the tribe, because he saw that the dominating force, which was totally dominating, and the Indian hanging on his culture at this particular point was being lost. Believe me, today, if you ever go down to Indian Reservation, you think there's going to be a bunch of Indians wearing a Seminole Indian jacket. For some reason, just recently, I got back into the kick of wearing Indian jackets. Looks kind of neat, kind of hides my fat gut, and kind of makes you stand out a little bit. And I'm chief of the Seminole tribe, that sort of thing. And it kind of fits the occasion, but you don't see this man over there wearing his Indian jacket because you cannot find clothes that big. But anyway, the average person on the reservation wants to be like the modern day man. I think the big, remember when old as I am, I've seen Three Musketeers, Randolph Scott, Hinch Ritter, Gene Autry, Hopalong Cassidy, Randolph Scott, did I say that? All those guys? Tarzan, that was me, and I like Tarzan. But my grandfathers and my uncles and the other members of the tribe would all look like Hopalong Cassidy, big black cat, they were these nerds,